Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis.
Welcome back to the Unforgiving 60 podcast and our very special double episode, A Tale of Two Andrews. Our second Andrew, Dr. Andrew Lee, MP, is a lawyer, an economist, a published author, and a far better podcast host than Tim or I. His show, The Good Life, Andrew Lee and Conversation, has been running for over 85 episodes and has included discussions on topics ranging from racism, gender equity and peak performance, to making wontons and feral robotic dogs. It's definitely worth checking out. On top of that, he also has a PhD in public policy from the Kennedy School at Harvard and is an accomplished distance runner, capable of completing a marathon averaging sub 4 minute kilometres. Now, if that wasn't enough, he's been a member of the Australian House of Representatives since 2010 and is representing the seat of Fenner in the ACT as part of the Australian Labor Party. Andrew, welcome.
G'day, Tim. G'day, Ben.
I thought we'd start off, as we often do, by just getting a bit of a background in yourself and how you got to where you are today.
So I grew up in Sydney and Melbourne, Malaysia and Indonesia. My parents were academics who, when they were overseas, worked in the aid program. So I guess, as some people describe themselves as army brats, I was a bit of an aid brat, moving around to seven different primary schools and the sort of slight disconnection from a solid friendship base that implies. My household was a sort of small p political one. My parents were very interested in what was going on in the world. There was a good sense that a life of service to others was a life well lived. I guess originating from the strongly Methodist background on both my parents' side. They'd met in church in Ivanhoe Methodist Church. And so while their Christianity and socialism had waned a little, there's probably some hint of a Christian socialist upbringing in the way in which they thought about the world. Then settled in one high school and got interested in law, studied law and worked for Michael Kirby on the High Court, who taught me more than probably anyone except my parents. Worked for a little bit in law, but then sort of got interested in this idea that what matters is the framework of incentives rather than the framework of rights. And so I then turned to study economics in the States, where I met my wife. Worked for half a dozen years as an economics professor at ANU. Went to politics in 2010.
It's very interesting you talk about that interest in incentives. I've done a little bit of study in complex adaptive systems theory, and I find that a really compelling way to sort of make sense of the world. And one of the things that it says is that one of the few things you can change about a complex adaptive system is the incentive structures within it. So it's really interesting for me when you look at organizations and how they've been incentivized and the resultant behaviors. And I take it you see that a fair bit through your economic studies and also into your current role.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I find thinking at the margin, approaching concepts in terms of trade-offs, being aware of opportunity costs and doing cost basic back-of-the-envelope cost-benefit analysis and net present value is a pretty useful way to think about most public policy problems. It also turns out to be the way in which I would answer most questions in my own life, ranging from what to eat to when to go to the doctor to whether to stay out for an extra hour drinking with mates or head home and be fresh in the morning.
Although it's funny sometimes, and we've spoken about Richard Thaler's work in behavioral economics, that even with that, you know, when you look at cost benefits, humans don't always choose the thing that's going to ultimately benefit them in the long run, do they?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, people sometimes talk about sort of these new developments in behavioral economics, but behavioral economics is now 20 odd years old. And while Thaler's just picked up the Nobel Prize, of course, Danny Kahneman got it a decade or so before him. And a lot of those insights are now incorporated into mainstream economics. When you look at superannuation, for example, I think we set up the super system in the early 1990s pretty much for perfectly informed, rational agents. We've now recognised that defaults really matter a lot, and the typical person doesn't need more choices, they need better defaults. So those insights are flowing through to public policy as well.
Now, Andrew, if we can step back and look sort of globally at some big picture issues, Tim and I are big fans of quotes, probably because we've got no original ideas. But one of the ones we particularly like is a Churchill quote, which in fact he's quoting someone else, but he says, it has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. Now, we've seen democracy throw up some pretty interesting stuff lately. We've got Brexit, we've got Trump, we've got Duterte in the Philippines, we almost had Le Pen in France, Wilders in the Netherlands. And then, of course, one of my favourite ones, we had Boaty McBoatface come up as the potential name of a British survey vessel.
And we have Ferry McFerryface with Sydney Harbour.
It, there you go.
All of which sound like the sort of thing that a Ukrainian leader who was a former comedian might have come up with.
100%. Are we, as in the people, to be trusted to make these sort of decisions?
Look, it's a really important question, and I certainly think that voters do get it right. But we've seen a rise in populism in part because we've gotten worse economic outcomes for many in the middle class and working class across the world. People in the United States have seen their wages stagnate and a whole lot of challenges in terms of falling social mobility. So it's not surprising in that context that you've seen these so-called deaths of despair, the rise of opioid addictions and deaths to overdoses and increasing suicide rates in some countries. So there is an economic piece to it. There's also a component which has to do with canny political entrepreneurs. Donald Trump, in some sense, has a similar playbook to Pat Buchanan before him, but is just a more effective political actor in implementing that approach to politics. And then the mainstream parties haven't done as good a job as we should have in making centrist ongoing economic reform interesting and engaging to a distracted electorate. We've seen some exceptions to that. I think Justin Trudeau has, notwithstanding his recent issues, managed to be pretty effective at engaging with a strong, exciting centrist agenda. Emmanuel Macron, likewise. So there's exceptions, but by and large, mainstream parties around the world have struggled to engage with the rise of populism. We're certainly doing our best here. We're talking in the midst of an election campaign, a few weeks out from polling day, and I'm very conscious as a candidate for a Social Democratic Party of a need to engage people who would otherwise be disaffected by politics.
Mm. In your book, Choosing Openness, you quote Orwell, in fact, and talking about distinguishing between patriotism, which is loving your country, generally a positive thing, and nationalism, which is that sort of more insidious cousin of it that's really manifested in people believing their country is better than all others. And it's interesting, you were talking just before about some political actors kind of hijacking that popular sentiment into forms of nationalism.
Yeah, and we're speaking on 26th of April, day after I had the honour to lay a wreath at the War Memorial. And so those two aspects of patriotism and nationalism are very much in my mind. Orwell, of course, writing in the shadow of World War II, so much aware that when you start thinking that no other country could hold a candle to yours, there is the risk that that hubris translates into a desire to invade Poland, and yet there is so much to be proud of and to love about Australia. So I really want to capture that love not just for Australia as it is, but also for our traditions, for Patterson and Mabo, for the traditions of egalitarianism and mateship and the fair go, which have the traditions of democracy, leading with the secret ballot, being the folks who invented the ballot box, the early extension of the franchise to women. There's so much to be proud of, but you don't want to let it go to your head. You want to also understand that we're operating in a global world, and that plenty of other countries have terrific things to teach us as well. And travel is one of the sheer joys of life.
Without a doubt. And I think also we tend to get these foundation myths, don't we, that, you know, we look back with rose-coloured glasses on our history and forget that where we are today is a result of a whole melting pot of different factors and not just some sort of purist idealistic notion of what it means to be an Australian.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I think about the Burkean view that tradition is the democracy of the dead. That so much of where we are now is a result of pretty careful decisions made by those who've gone before us. So naturally we should be looking to reform where we can, but we also want to ask the question, how did things get to where they are now? Is there a good reason for the way our institutions are set up in this way? So, for example, in the case of let's abolish the states, my response is, well, actually, those state boundaries may not be perfect, but probably if you sat down to do an ideal federal structure right now, you'd come up with something that didn't look all that different from what we've got. On the other hand, would you sit down now and write a constitution that said that the head of state had to be somebody who lived in a castle on the other side of the world of a particular religion and bloodline? No, you probably wouldn't do that one. So maybe it makes sense to become a republic, but not abolish the states.
Andrew, you studied at the Kennedy School at Harvard. You studied a PhD in public policy. What motivated the decision to study overseas, and how influential was that on where you are now?
I was always intrigued by the notion of being able to go to the other side of the world and get a better perspective on your own country. I suppose it's that thing about you know you're going to miss your country, but you also know that if you want to make a real impact on public policy, it helps to be around not just the best people in Australia, but around some of the best people in the world. And I loved studying at Harvard. It was like drinking from a fire hydrant. My thesis chair was Christopher Jenks, a splendid sociologist who probably would have trained as an economist if he'd come back and done it again today. David Elwood and Carolyn Hoxby were on the committee. I worked closely with Robert Putnam when I was there. Worked with Martin Feldstein, learned from Martin Feldstein, who was on the chaired Reagan's Council of Economic Advisers, and Jeff Liebman, who chaired the National Economic Council under Clinton. And all of those people were at the cutting edge of what they did. And at the same time, we had a terrific bunch of Aussies. We set up a thing called the Half-Baked Ideas Seminar.
It sounds like our podcast.
Well, exactly. And the idea was we would deliberately float an idea that we knew we're on the wrong side of the world from Australia, was not going to be perfect, but encouraged all of us to keep on thinking about policy challenges in Australia. And that was an enormously rewarding part of what I did over in the States. And many of my best mates are people who I met when I was at the Kennedy School, people like David Madden and McGregor Duncan and Peter Tynan. It's sort of odd that you go to the other side of the world and find a bunch of Aussies who then end up being your closest friends in the world. Oh, and I shouldn't, of course, leave that answer without saying the very best thing about going to Harvard was I met my wife Gwyneth over there, who made the very very generous decision to come back to Australia with me.
Yeah, that would have been a fundamental error to omit that. And before we leave the continental US, what lessons could we learn from US politics? You know, we've been watching various regimes over the years do it in different ways. As you're a studious observer and having studied at Harvard, what do you think we could take away, maybe in a positive sense, but potentially also in a negative sense from US politics?
I mean, it's a much wider political spectrum. I remember someone once commenting that all of Australian politics would fit inside the US Democratic Party. And it's also got some big and interesting characters. And so the oratory of a Clinton or an Obama is certainly something that inspires all of us who sit down to try and trudge out our own little contribution on the Australian speaking circuit. But there's a willingness to use words like love in the political discourse, which I think is perhaps healthy, perhaps to show a little more emotion than Australians typically do. There's also a need to engage with issues of deep deprivation as well. But I wouldn't want our health system to look more American. I don't see a great deal of advantage of funding your schools based on the value of the properties in the local neighbourhood. I don't see that gives you very much in terms of social mobility. An electoral system which seems to exclude far too many Americans from having a say in their nation's future, I think is one of the things that's holding the US back. On the innovation front, I mean, the energy of the innovative clusters around Silicon Valley or Austin, Texas, or Route 128 is pretty exciting. And you even get that sort of spilling over. You're in a local Starbucks in those places, and there's a sense of energy and creativity in the air. Americans will get back from spring break announcing that they've just been off to Kenya. They've decided to set up their own non-profit to deal with homelessness in Nairobi. And the chutzpah that involves is kind of impressive.
I'm a big fan of the Americans. I spent a year there. We've worked with them a lot through the military. And I think there's a lot to be admired about their society, notwithstanding the shortfalls that certainly do exist. But one of the things that's always struck me is that they're very willing to celebrate their entrepreneurs. They're very willing to champion those people who are having a crack and who are trying to make a go of it. Whereas I tend to feel in Australia, we're often the tall poppy society. We want to cut down those people who are trying to rise above the parapet.
Yeah, I mean, the tall poppy syndrome can be overblown. We're all pretty proud of Cathy Freeman when she came back with that gold medal in 2000. I don't recall anyone sort of saying that Cathy needed to be cut down to size. And, you know, in the tech space, I detect a lot of pride with the Atlassian guys, Mike Cannon-Brooks and Scott Farquhar, for what they've managed to achieve. I think our tall poppy syndrome is less about being successful and more about thinking that just because you're successful, you're better than those around you. In that sense, it's probably not an unhealthy thing, given that we know that a lot of success in life has to do with luck. Take my own example. As somebody with a scrawny build and poor eyesight, I probably would have been easy prey for a saber-toothed tiger through most of human history. It just so happens that being able to write and talk with some reasonable facility produces a decent outcome in the moment in history in which I've been lucky enough to be alive. But there's an awful lot of good fortune I see in my own career and plenty of others when I look at other successful people. So we want to be a little less inclined to kick the unsuccessful into the gutter or put the successful up on pedestals. For me, that's what the tall poppy syndrome's about.
On writing, on talking, you're certainly well-travelled, Andrew. You're well-read, you're well-studied, but you're also well-written. And you co-authored a book with David Burchell in 2002. I love the title of it. The title is The Prince's New Clothes, Why Do Australians Dislike Their Politicians? So I've got to ask the question, why do Australians dislike their politicians?
Well, before I answer it, I should say that it is a problem so bad that our publisher, UNSW Press, insisted the cover image be a picture of one dog sniffing another dog's backside. That meant that when the Parliamentary bookshop in Australian Parliament House were sent copies of the book, they refused to put it on their shelves, saying that it was too offensive. So my book and Mark Latham's book of quotations, titled A Conga Line of Suckholes, are the only two books reputedly to have been banned from sale at the Australian Parliament House bookshop.
Well, it's funny you mention that. We tried to get a copy and it's out of print, so I'm not sure whether it's sold out or it's out of print for another reason.
Indeed, indeed. Since it's the Lady Chatterley's lover of political science. I think there's a number of things going on. Certainly, we as politicians have been too quick to jump to sound bites and move away from deep explanations, where there's a lot of us trying to push back at that style of politics. I look at Bill Shorten's 70-odd town hall meetings, which are trying to move away from soundbite politics and into conversational politics. But it is hard in an increasingly fast-paced media landscape, in which the duration of political soundbites have gone from about 30 seconds in the 1970s to about 12 seconds in the 1990s to now about 7 seconds or so. So politics used to be in paragraphs and then in sentences and now in phrases. And that makes it harder to communicate complicated ideas and build up trust. It also means that you get more stories around scandals and backflips and fewer about the substance of good announcements. We've also, found ourselves in a moment in history in which those forces of populism have been inspired by the more rapid pace of change. So there's a nice book by Thomas Friedman which argues that particularly since 2007, the pace of technological change has sped up, and that's left many people feeling that the world's going too fast and I want to get off. He talks about the rise of the iPhone, the transformative impact of that, the impact of gene editing technologies, the very rapid shifts in the way in which we consume information, just as having a sort of a deeply unsettling effect, which again potentially drives people away from traditional institutions such as big business or churches or large organised mass political parties.
I'd like to talk about diversity now, Andrew. You make this fantastic quote in Choosing Openness where you compare a distrust of diversity to wisdom teeth, with the argument that from an evolutionary point of view, they were probably both once useful, but they've now since lapsed into redundancy. There's a lot of efforts being made in many quarters to increase diversity, but in many cases, what we're seeing is kind of surface-level diversity, so just based on sort of demographic characteristics, gender and race and religion, that sort of thing. Have you got any ideas or any thoughts on how we can promote true diversity and allow true diversity of thought and sort of safety to discuss ideas like your Half-Baked Ideas Club at Harvard?
Yeah, and you know, I'd be fascinated on the reflections that both of you have as to how the optimal degree of diversity within special operations teams, where you want to solve complicated problems, but unit cohesion is also absolutely critical. I look around successful organisations, whether they be sporting teams or businesses or society as a whole, and see terrific strength in diversity. It brings a plethora of new ideas in. It allows the interplay of different perspectives. More diverse boards seem to perform better. If you have a city that is a monoculture, then pretty much you can guarantee that that city is not going to be the most prosperous in the area. And yet we are, as humans, conditioned through hundreds of thousands of years to think of those who are unlike us as being dangerous. For most of human history, 99% of human history, the best strategy to employ when confronted by somebody you don't recognise is hit them on the head or run away from them. Because for most of human history, we've lived in these little groups of a couple of hundred people in which difference was a sign of danger. So we have our sort of evolutionary upbringing running against the upbringing pushing against diversity, while all of the economics suggests that we can benefit greatly if we're to put aside our monkey mind and engage with those who are a bit different from us. So it doesn't surprise me that where you look at surveys of diversity and trust, that you see an initial impact of diversity driving down levels of trust, but then a longer term, you see that abating. I think about my parents who never would have considered dating a Catholic. These days, the distinction between Catholics and Protestants is essentially meaningless to my three little boys. And so hopefully in the future, you see sexuality and race going the way of the religious differences.
And certainly you talk about the three waves of immigration into Australia, the sort of Italians and Greeks after World War II, the Vietnamese and Lebanese in the 70s and 80s, and now the contemporary, I guess this latest wave from more Middle Eastern countries. And you cite in Choosing Openness that we've had great assimilation, like multi-generational, but largely successful assimilation of the first two waves. Certainly my wife is from Italian heritage. Her grandparents were part of that first wave, and you wouldn't find a more Australian person than her father. What are your thoughts in this current wave from the Middle Eastern side of things? Is religion a complicating factor here, and in particular lack of separation of church and state in many of the countries from which the current wave of Australian migrants have come?
Look, I think difference is always challenging, but that church and state critique was, of course, made of Catholics. You look at the criticisms made of John F. Kennedy when he was running for president, and his Republican critics would say, look, you can't possibly have a Catholic in the White House because Catholics are required to obey the Pope. And so they will be unable to make this distinction between their religion and their civic duties. So it's not a new argument, and I think the way of dealing with that diversity is to better get to know people who've migrated from different countries, to recognise the strength of those civic cultures, the particular approaches to beauty and to community engagement, and to ensure that our conception of what it is to be Australian isn't governed by stereotypes but by values. So we're not a nation who loves FJ Holdens and Vegemite sandwiches and cricket and white blokes in hats sitting in the sun. We're a nation that is guided by values like multiculturalism, mateship, and the fair go. And those values are able to hold us together in a way that the stereotype.
Yeah, and that kind of future is challenged, I'd imagine, by the declining degrees of community. We don't seem to tend to associate as much with our physical neighbours, and in many cases we're associating more with online communities that are sort of based on these stereotypical beliefs rather than the real life communities. You mention in your book, or in Choosing Openness, that we don't quite know what the ideal strategy to build community is yet, but you talk about the idea of randomised trials to look at different options and to double down on those that are most effective at fostering civic engagement. What sort of programs might be included in these sort of trials?
Wow. Well, so that's a question that sort of spans two of my books. So I'm trying to work out exactly how to tackle it. But let me go to the civic community question first. Mm. We've certainly seen a significant decline in a lot of those civic institutions. So in his book Bowling Alone in 2000, Robert Putnam documented some of the worrying trends of the United States. And a decade later, I did a much shorter contribution called Disconnected, which found that we'd seen a decline not only in church going and union membership and the share of people casting a valid vote, but also in organisations like Scouts, Guides, Rotary, Lions. We ran surveys, which we've replicated as recently as last year, which showed that Australians were less likely to know their neighbours and had fewer close friends. So I do worry about that decline of civic community, and it's probably one of the factors driving the political disengagement and distrust of politicians that we talked about before. In terms of the solutions, I see them as being partly drawn from community. We've been holding a series of reconnected forums in the last few years since I've taken over as the Shadow Minister for Charities and Not-for-Profits. And in those, we bring together local community leaders who are running charities and not-for-profits in a particular area, and just break into small groups and talk about what's working. And you get all kinds of interesting strategies. The singles tree planting events that Greening ACT does, the kayaking waterway cleanups that are done in Newcastle, the way in which Parkrun has had success throughout Australia in having a very simple model, 5 kilometres, 8 a.m, Saturday morning, and it's free. The way in which mothers' groups and book groups have bucked the trend of declining civic engagement. So we're trying to sort of build those learnings up. I think there's a role for government in this, but I think there's also a lot of work that can be effectively done at a community level if we share the knowledge as to how to make these things work. I am a fan of randomised trials, and I've thought a little, but probably not enough, about how randomised trials might be used to evaluate successful strategies for building civic community.
Mm. Andrew, from lawyer to academic to advisor to politician, but also to running.
Oh, good. I was hoping
in 2017, you ran the Tokyo Marathon in 2 hours 42 seconds. In fact, Ben's had the calculator out. What does that equate to?
Would I be right in saying it's 3:51 k's, Andrew?
Something in that order.
So you obviously find time to do some training, because that's an incredible time. Maybe the same question asked in a different way. What do you do for you?
So running for me is a great head cleaner. It's the way I like to start the day. I'm incredibly fortunate to live in a part of Canberra where I can be in the bush within about a minute. So this morning, it was just a light run day, so went out for a very easy 10K along the bush trails there. And when you've got the birds singing above you, kangaroos jumping out of the way, you probably saw about 20 kangaroos this morning, and you're running on a nice soft surface, which is good for your knees, it's pretty hard to get back from that and not feel good about the world. My dad was a marathon runner. My grandfather was a marathon runner who ran 50 miles on his 50th birthday. So I guess I've got the genes for it and probably the build for it. I'm also fairly uncoordinated. I can't catch or kick or throw. So essentially all I can do is run. So I've made the most of doing what I can. And just love the running community as well, particularly the Indigenous Marathon Project started by Rob DiCostello, where I've run all the World Marathon Majors wearing an Indigenous Marathon Project supporter singlet, but also benefited greatly from talking with Rob DiCostello, one of my childhood heroes, about the best way to train and to stay fit. And I love... you guys would know this as much as anyone, that joy of pushing yourself to your physical limits, which as you get into middle age, I'm even more grateful than I was as a kid for the ability to push really hard. It drives all the sort of clutter of the day out of your mind and just leaves you with that sort of hard gem-like focus after a good training session. There's a phrase called level up day, which a cyclist called Jen Bobette came up with, which is this combination of speed and ease, of force and grace, the happiness of moving as quickly as you can, given your physical limitations. So I yearn for level up day when I'm out there, and every few training sessions I find it.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. Staying with the question, what do you do for you? Recreational reading, if you were to reach for a book or a piece of literature, what would that be?
Just finished Tim Winton's Shepherd's Hut, which is good for a person who tends to open a book too late at night and fall asleep too quickly, because it's largely following one guy who's going on a trip. And so when you don't have 20 different characters and interlocking storylines, but you have one bloke walking along, it's easier to pick up the tale. I've also been trying to read to my boys. Find books which are a little above their reading level and read them out loud in the evenings. So My eldest son Sebastian and I just got through Longitude, and we're reading David Hunt's True Gert at the moment, which is a rollickingly entertaining Australian history story. And then do a lot of podcasts, yours of course, but really enjoy Malcolm Gladwell, Michael Lewis, Guy Raz's podcasts. My friend David Madden has a terrific one. Yeah, there's just so much great podcasting material out there at the moment, which helps to broaden the mind and just remind you what an interesting world we're living in.
So, how do you fit it all in? You easy 10K run this morning. I think I've run about 10Ks in the last 6 months, so I'm sort of on par, I suppose. But
I ran 12 today, but certainly not at sub 4 minute pace.
In fact, you mentioned that your 10K run made you feel really happy about the world and yourself. To make us feel really bad about ourselves, what was your time for an easy 10Ks these days, Andrew?
So I run probably about 4.5 minute pace when I'm doing an easy run. I'd push below. So the simplest training maxim I've ever heard is it goes in haiku form. Run a lot of miles, some faster than your race pace, rest once in a while. So I try and adhere to that, get as many Ks in as I can, which sometimes involves sleeping a little bit less than you would otherwise, get a speed session in every few days and try and take a day off a week. My speed sessions, I'd try and get under that race pace, and easy sessions, set a sort of a min decay over it.
So how strict are you on routine to cram all of this into a working day?
I tend to get up early, so you know, somewhere between 4:30 and 5:30, ideally get a little bit of writing done before I head out for a run. But I'm aware that when I'm at my most productive is when I've got the best routines, and that the thing that is killing me at the moment is feeling like I'm spending too much time answering email. I think we as humanity will figure out a better way of communicating with one another than passing around a couple of hundred emails a day. But right now we seem stuck in a kind of bad equilibrium for email. And then, you know, just we're in the middle of an election campaign, so there's a lot of travel, and then a lot of the engagement with my own electors and with electors and stakeholders in other parts of the country. That's all immensely rewarding, but you also then want to make sure that you can switch off politics and switch on to kids in those moments you get to spend time with them.
Andrew, do you schedule deliberate time for thinking in your day?
Only really as part of running. I probably should do it more. I've experimented with short meditation, with Headspace, and I certainly find that leaves me in a good space. But at the moment, the meditation is coming through running, and particularly through the hard running sessions. I'm really conscious that after a good hard hill session where I push the heart rate right up, that I'm a nicer person for the remainder of the day. I don't think it's just the endorphins. I think there's a sort of purifying aspect to a good speed session, which at least for now is taking the part that meditation would otherwise take in my life.
Andrew, what advice would you have for someone who was considering a career in politics?
Be aware that there's a huge amount of luck in politics, and so regardless of how good you are and how much you merit an elected office, chance will play a massive role. So don't do something you hate in order to improve your chances of politics. Do things you love and focus on doing them well, but stay engaged. Recognise that most politicians are from mainstream political parties, and so if you're serious about getting into politics, probably your best channel will be through a mainstream political party. And the joining a party doesn't require that you adhere to every single policy that party takes forward. That there is, this is a team sport, and just as members of a footy team might well believe that the play ought to go left on the field and make that case on the in the locker room. When they get out on the field, if the decision is to play the ball to the right, everyone plays the ball to the right. So I've always thought of politics as being a team sport, and I'd encourage people to join a political party if they're serious about making a difference, a party that has a credible chance of supplying a prime minister. And make sure you've got something that is unique to offer. Politics is at its worst when it's drawn from a narrow gene pool, and at its best when you've got a diverse party room. Again, going back to that question about the strength and diversity. So I really find myself now, after 9 years in the Labor Party room, reverting to type much more as a former economics professor, recognising that my value added to the room is bringing economic thinking in, and that others will be tapped into to thinking from the perspective of a paediatrician or a former social worker or a former principal or a former truck driver or a former business executive. All of those different frameworks are useful, but they become much less useful if we all try and behave in exactly the same way. So that's for somebody who is contemplating politics to develop a unique skill is pretty valuable.
Do you think that ability to be your authentic self is a function of age? Certainly from my perspective, if I look back, I reckon I was trying to play the role of an army officer in my early years, and it was only sort of towards the end of my career in the military that I felt much more comfortable, being my more authentic self rather than trying to play to the type that was perceived. Have you found that in your own journey?
Yes, absolutely. And I think we're too quick to envisage that there is one kind of leadership, and that leadership is the sort of shouty, masculine, stand up the front with a deep voice kind of leadership that has traditionally prevailed in society. When I was studying at Harvard, one of my favourite courses was drawing on Ron Heifetz's notion of adaptive leadership, the idea that leadership, particularly in a political context, is about creating a crucible in which groups can make difficult decisions about contested problems. And that's a very different style of leadership, but one that I think we need to foster on issues like Indigenous reconciliation, for example. Politics is still pretty macho. The environment of question time is too shouty, and privileges a particular style of communication. Fast-paced, shouted insults do much better than considered arguments. So yeah, we need to encourage people to find their authentic voices more readily. As you say, it's something that comes a little with age, but we can also create better environments for people to feel comfortable in their own skins. We don't do a great job in politics of mentoring and of handovers. I think of my job as a local MP. My predecessor, Bob McMullen, who I greatly admire, stepped out of the job one day. I stepped back into the job the next day. If there's a change of government in a couple of weeks' time, the ministers won't overlap as CEOs would in a CEO succession plan for a firm. One set of ministers will leave, the next set of ministers will come in. So to the extent that we can have better handover procedures, will probably serve the country better. But these are issues that as you can tell, they're sort of nascent ideas. I'm still struggling through exactly how we'd implement.
Andrew, how do you define happiness?
Wow. I think it goes to a sense of deep satisfaction in what you're achieving. A notion of being part of something bigger than yourself. When we in economics think about utility or well-being, we don't envisage simply that will have to do with the maximum number of neurons that are lit up in your brain when you bite into a lovely piece of chocolate, but that it also it has to do with living a life in which you feel you're being well used. And in that sense, you know, that drives me as a policymaker to think about things like the inherent value of work to someone's identity, and the notion that that a good life isn't simply one in which someone maximises their income, but it's also one in which each person in society feels that they're playing an important role in their community. For me, it's also about getting the work-family balance right. I feel as though I struggle to spend enough focused time with my kids, and one of the things that I'm working on at the moment is getting more of that time. I'm also aware that there's a value to gratitude. There's a lovely line by Neil Walsh, "The struggle ends where the gratitude begins." And I try to, when I do the do a diary entry at the end of the day, I just have a little dictaphone on the car dashboard, mostly for, just for myself, just to get it all out of my head. One of the last things I do is a gratitude exercise, just identifying one thing in my day which has brought me pleasure and for which I'm grateful. So that's again a way of trying to center myself on true long-term happiness and not the sort of ephemera that you can sometimes strive for.
The fleeting sort of materialistic type happiness that we often think is the, you know, correlated with success. We, within our podcast, we draw a lot of inspiration from, obviously, the Rudyard Kipling poem, If, and also the Flecker poem, Golden Journey to Samarkand. Are there any particular lines? You're obviously incredibly well-read, and we've discussed a number of books, but are there any particular lines, books or quotes that you find inspirational?
So one that I have on my computer screen at the moment is a quote from Walter Pater back in 1873, which I look at when I think about trying to focus, and I'll read it out to you because it's just in front of me now. "Not the fruit of experience, but experience itself is the end. A counted number of pulses only is given to us of a variegated dramatic life. How shall we pass most swiftly from point to point and be present always at the focus where the greatest number of vital forces unite in their purest energy? To burn always with this hard, gem-like flame, to maintain this ecstasy, this success in life." And I like it because it just, it reminds you that there are so many things you could be doing at any given time. You'll never finish all of those books. You'll never get through all of those interesting articles that people are putting on social media. You've got to find the things that will make you burn with a sense of gem-like intensity. But I do love If as well, and it was listening to your podcast that inspired me the other day to go and print out If onto a piece of nice paper and put it on the wall of my eldest son, who reads it from time to time. So thank you for that.
It's our pleasure. We love hearing that. I think both Tim and I, If was a part of our childhood, and I think it is a wonderful, you know, lessons in life, just a really good meditation on what it means to be a good human being.
Yeah, and it's, you know, that lovely, I suppose I'm influenced as Kipling was by the Stoic philosophy in life, that idea that you shouldn't worry too much about what others think about you, but about the impact you'll leave on the world. And one of my favourite tales from the Stoics, Tim Ferriss mentions it on his podcast, is that they would sometimes put on unfashionable clothes and walk down to the local markets and just walk around looking out of place in order to remind themselves that these things don't really matter very much, that it's okay to be out of step with the common fashions. What really matters is to do good and important work, not to get daily smiles.
Exactly. And I think also not to expect that there's going to be some kind of karmic reward for this, that, you know, to accept that life isn't fair, that, you know, really bad people can lead long and happy lives and really good people can have these short, miserable ones. But that isn't how you should be measuring success in life.
Yes, and I did a podcast interview on my podcast, The Good Life, with Martha Nussbaum, the Chicago philosopher. One of the things I found most fascinating there is her insistence that anger is a dumb emotion, that sure, you can have righteous anger in which you're inspired by frustration at a social problem like Indigenous deprivation, but the idea of anger as Tom hurt me, so I will hurt Tom, that's a dumb idea. So she argues we should do as much as we can to banish that notion of anger from our own lives. I've been intrigued by this idea of a politics of love, which some New Zealanders have written about. It goes back to Mandela and Gandhi and Martin Luther King. Obama touched on it a little, but the notion of an agape style love, generalized love as an inspiring force for politics, to me is an intriguing one. I haven't quite gotten my head around how it would work in practice. I'm not sure what a politics of love means for monetary policy, for example. But you saw in Jacinta Ardern's response to the Christchurch shootings a sense of the value of that loving approach to politics in uniting a community around a common cause.
I think the politics of love is a great way to wrap up this discussion. Now, Tim and I vowed that we weren't going to talk about politics. I think every question we asked you was actually about politics, but we kept it away from partisan politics, so I guess that's something. Andrew, thank you so much for your time. Absolutely magic to speak to you.
Absolute pleasure, and a real honour to be on your podcast. So keep up the great work. Love listening to your podcast. You're exploring such important issues.
Thanks, Andrew.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's rounds complete. Two Andrews down. We hope you really enjoyed the Tale of Two Andrews. As always, we are keen to hear your feedback, either on this episode or indeed on anything we've discussed. You can get in touch with us through social media or directly on debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. Until we speak next, we hope that you're successful in filling your own unforgiving minutes with 60 seconds worth of distance run. See ya.
Summer dream.